All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum.
Stay on target.
Maximum. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the Read Rothbard podcast. We're back at it again. My friend Robert is with me, and we're here to talk about Red Dawn and some other goings-ons. Wolverines, my friend.
I haven't seen the movie in years, but I know they shot that a lot.
You know, I thought
I recalled
that as well, but I think they only yell it two or three times in the whole movie.
I still feel like I should interrupt you every once in a while randomly shouting Wolverines.
That's totally fine. I remember interrupting you,
Wolverines,
with fucking cockass in our episode one many, many times.
Yeah, I think you did. So
I think it's one of those things that when you're 8 years old and you watch a movie and you're like, oh my God, this is an awesome movie, and they say this one thing, so I'm going to say it all the time, you know, for the next month. That might be where we get the repetition of thinking they say it a lot in the movie.
Yeah, so it's actually just us. We said it a million times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember running around your house, and we'd be playing war or something. We'd say, die, commie.
Sweet.
And I think that was before I really knew what a commie was, and you know, now I'm like, hey, smart kid, right?
Yeah, I don't think I really knew what a commie was for a long time, like decades. I just knew that the people didn't like them, but now they're back in fashion. Everybody likes them again. So
yeah, now it's cool, right? Now it's like the hipster millennial type thing.
Yeah,
you know,
everybody
grew up in your parents' house and everything's kind of provided for you, so why not just continue that lifestyle once you're out in the world, you know?
Yeah. I don't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah, exactly. So before we get to it, got a couple of things housekeeping-wise. So we run readrothbard.com. Everyone knows that, or unless this is the first time you've heard us. We've got Amazon links, a link to Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, readitfor.me. We've got a tip jar. We'd like feedback. Comments, likes, shares, whatever, suggestions for things, all that stuff. We've got a bookstore. We're on iTunes now. We're on Google Play Music. And Robert, you had suggested a podcast name to the listening audience last week. Enemy
and
of
you
the
stole
state.
It.
I stole it.
You stole it. You didn't let anybody
I
else
committed
to it.
You IP it. Theft.
You son of a bitch.
Now, the cool thing with this podcast, the new one, it's just Murray Rothbard lectures. So I've posted the first four. It's a complete series of an introduction to Austrian economics. And that one is also on iTunes, Google Play Music, YouTube, and on Podomatic, where we host the Read Rothbard podcast. And so between the two, folks listening will have at least 2 or 3 hours of content out of us each week. And I mean, well, I take that back a little bit. You'll get maybe an hour out of us, and you'll get an hour or two out of Murray each week.
Wolverines! Plus, if you could rate us on iTunes, give us a rating, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, whatever it does to make us stand out or give us some kind of feedback, that's super helpful. We have been getting a little bit of feedback from some folks, and it's been fairly general so far. Just, hey, I'm enjoying listening, and just keep doing what you're doing. And hopefully we will eventually get a little bit more specific information, because I feel like we have been sort of evolving or morphing from week to week a little bit, so we don't really have a consistent format or style just yet. And so this general, just keep doing what you're doing, is to me like, well, we're kind of all over the place, so just keep doing that.
Yeah, which is fine with me, because I just like having conversations, so whatever, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially how this started out, just us talking. And we've been doing it for a few years, just you and me, having all sorts of conversations about this kind of thing. But we've both been studying and learning. And we launched this podcast, what is it, about 5-6 months ago now. And I think it's, you know, we've been, like I said, evolving and growing in our thought processes. And we still don't have agreement on everything or answers to everything. But I think that's one of the beauties of kind of having a principled thought and then trying to come to scenarios where you try to figure out a solution. One of the comments I made in the Tom Woods group the other day was related to this, where I was like, most people argue, my study says this, well, my study over here says that, and they both have holes in them. But if you argue from first principles and then you still have disagreement, then you might be onto something actually interesting.
Indeed. Indeed, yeah, we try and argue from first principles. And one of the first people that I remember saying that was Steph Molyneux, and we can maybe talk about him a little bit later. And it's surprising to see him kind of go back on to that a little bit. Maybe I haven't been following him enough lately. But, yeah, he did a video just yesterday that kind of took me by surprise. I mean, he rehashed a bunch of his arguments that I've seen recently, or at least lately. But then he threw some new crap at me that really shocked me. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. Just a little taste.
Yeah, just a little bit of a taste. And to comment on that, you know, I have gone back and forth over the years listening to him in kind of little binges, and then I grow tired a little bit and then come back a few months later. And, you know, for the most part, he has helped a lot. He puts some pretty good arguments out there, especially on the children not being spanked and the circumcision thing that I took to heart. I agree with him that, you know, I don't hit my kids. I try to not initiate force against them. And to your credit, Robert, we used to think putting our child in timeout, where we physically move them somewhere to be in timeout, wasn't a violation of the NAP. You pointed out to me that it actually is. So now we reverse and we say, okay, you're being bad, so you're getting a timeout. You're going to stay where you are, and we are going to remove ourselves.
Which I think is a fairly elegant solution. It basically teaches them that they're acting in such a way that people don't want to be around them, which I think gets the message across fairly well.
Yeah, it's the ostracism thing, and that's also another Steph thing that many forms of punishment that would be voluntary and in a free market would be ostracism, where you choose to not associate. And I think that's a, like you were alluding, a solid thing.
Yeah, and it goes against, you know, a lot of these common status objections to anarchy, where they say, well, people would just take over and start initiating violence against other people, as if there aren't any natural, you know, nonviolent means to resist that. As if,
yeah, they seem to think that the only deterrence is that there's a government and that there'd be no other repercussions.
Right. I mean, humans are social animals, and they want to be around people. They want to be liked. They want to have friends. If you went around attacking everybody and screwing over your business, you know, associates, or screwing over your customers or what have you, you would quickly find yourself out of all those things. People wouldn't want to be around you. People wouldn't want to be your customer. They wouldn't want to be your business associate. And you would quickly learn that, hey, this isn't winning me any friends. I'm not being very good at business. And, you know, there's just these normal everyday things that we all do all the time to keep each other in check, to give each other rewards, and to make these tiny little punishments when we disagree with their behavior. And people like act like, you know, without the threat of government, all those things, all those checks wouldn't be enough or wouldn't exist. When those things are more than enough. I mean, yeah, you're going to have wolves. You're going to have some psychos. And there are private defense companies for that, and there are people that are armed, and that's what being able to defend yourself is all about. But 99 times out of 100, all that's required is a child to be properly raised, nonviolently, and to have caring people in your life that will help you and help you learn and understand how to interact with other human beings in a respectful way. And you don't even necessarily need to be taught that stuff. It just comes naturally to people. That, hey, I'm happier when I'm around people. I'm happier when I have friends to interact with. And so I'm going to act in ways that continue those things. Those are incredibly powerful tools. Superpower. If we are all psychopaths and we didn't care about people and we just wanted to be alone and we didn't care who we screwed over and we couldn't associate, we couldn't, you know, empathize with other people, then we'd be talking about a different situation. But we're not. The psychopaths are like 10% of the population, and those, and I would argue that psychopaths are not born. Maybe 1 or 2%, I don't even know about that, but I would say the majority, and I'm not like pointing to any study or whatever, I'm not an expert in this, but it seems to me that psychopaths are made by child abuse situations. When you are attacked as a child, you disassociate from the abuse as a self-defense mechanism. And so throughout your life, you have trouble associating and empathizing with other people because you have this built-in defense mechanism that's on overdrive, kicked in, turned on, hardcore, because you don't want to get too attached to people because they might attack you and hurt you and whatever. And it's like, you're all messed up, essentially.
Right, and you're essentially shown that violence is the means to solve problems, and that makes statism rather acceptable.
Sure.
Which
so anyway,
is kind of a
tough
argument.
Got off all on that, but yeah, ostracism, super big, strong, and people just naturally do it, and it happens constantly. It's probably why you have like blinders on about it, like statists have blinders on about it, because it's constant. It's like it falls into the background noise. You don't even notice it's happening. You're constantly, when you're talking to someone, you see their body language, whether they're being receptive, whether they're happy, whether they're sad, whether they like you or not. It's just going on in the back of your little reptile primate brain, and you're not even really thinking about it. But it's constantly happening, and it's super powerful.
Indeed, sir. Well, hey,
yeah.
that was our introductory bit. Ba-bam. Let's get to Red Dawn.
Wolverines.
So Red Dawn is
what is it?
It's kind of cool.
84?
Yeah, it's 1984. So this was a movie that Murray was actually around for. He saw and wrote a review about. So that's kind of a cool thing that we have his review about it, and then we can of course comment on it and still watch it today.
Yeah. So what do you got? You got Patrick Swayze, fresh off of what, Roadhouse maybe? You got Charlie.
I think Roadhouse was later. I mean, I go into my Patrick Swayze fan database. I think Roadhouse was, what, 87, maybe?
Okay. Do you have any idea what he came off of? I don't know.
No. Let's take a look, shall we? Let's pull up the Mr. Google device and
go to your homepage, which is just your Patrick Swayze fan page.
Well, he's on the background.
Yes.
He was in The Outsiders, Renegades, The Comeback Kid.
I've never heard of.
Skate Town, USA. Yeah. Dirty Dancing was 87. Roadhouse was 89.
Okay. Roadhouse was way later.
Yeah, way later. I do like in Family Guy that Peter says Roadhouse like a bunch of times just throughout the seasons, just randomly.
Just Roadhouse? Doesn't he usually do that when he does like a roundhouse kick on somebody or something? I don't know.
Something like that. I haven't seen it in a while. But I do remember him saying that a lot.
Okay, so then you got him, and then you got Charlie Sheen, and those are like your big two actors, right? Is there anybody else that I maybe heard of, like Jennifer Grey or somebody?
Yeah, Jennifer Grey's in it, and there's also Leah Thompson, who might be vaguely familiar to folks. There's Harry Dean Stanton, who is, I guess he was a famous dude in the 80s, and a guy named Wayne Smith, who plays the mayor of the town, and he is like one of those character actor types, like when you see the movie, you're like, oh yeah, I've seen that guy a million times. Couldn't tell you his name, but I've seen him a bunch.
Mm. A lot of good character actors in the 80s that I grew up just knowing, oh, that guy's in this movie. Oh, that's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any question, he's playing the villain because typecasting is a thing.
Yep. Sorry, SJW Warriors. Typecasting is a thing.
It is. So lay on me, what is it in the future? Is it current day? What is it? Is this the year 1984? What's the deal?
Yeah, I'll just kind of peruse the Wikipedia. I did just watch this film recently, but this will help organize my thoughts. Mm-hmm. So it is pretty much present day. I believe it's somewhere in Colorado. It's a small town, and these kids are in school. And, well, before I say that, the movie starts out with these title screens that say the United States has become isolated from Europe and has withdrawn from NATO. Soviet Union's been expanding, and Ukrainian wheat harvest fails during the communist coup, and there's action in Mexico. So there's all these like dominoes falling into place for the isolation of the United States and making it vulnerable to attack from Mexico through the communist regime in the USSR. And I think there's some Hondurans or something that are part of this deal. But these kids are in school and they see paratroopers start dropping down in the, in their town, like right outside their windows. And the teacher goes out and confronts them and he's like, hey, what the hell's going on here? What are you guys doing? And they shoot him. And of course everyone freaks out and chaos ensues. People start trying to escape from the school. Oh, and I guess there were Cuban and Soviet troops.
Okay. Cubans and Soviets are allies, which makes sense. They were in the Cold War.
Yeah. I mean, this is, 20 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis or 18 years after, so I was still fairly fresh. And there's the arms race and the Cold War going on still, and everyone was still up about how the USSR was, like, out-competing the U.S. and how communism was, like, way more productive and they were a big threat and all that stuff.
Whereas if you had just listened to Rothbard, you would have known that communism is untenable, even though there's a good argument to be made that, Russia really, it seemed like it'd be more fascist than communist. I mean, they called themselves communists. But I don't know if you could call it true communism. I mean, it's authoritarian communism, I suppose.
Are you making an ANCOM argument that, that wasn't true communism and therefore it failed?
No, I'm saying any kind of communism would fail. But I think that there is something to be said for the rift between the authoritarian ANCOMs and the like hippie ANCOMs.
Oh, okay. Well, to my mind, there was an evolution of communism ever since Lenin came to power. Like, as soon as he came to power, things fell apart, and then he revised his plan and allowed some trade to go on so they could kind of recover from that. But then also there was all sorts of aid from even the U.S. I think there was some wheat harvest that was sold off to the Russians in a subsidized manner. And they're supposed to be our sworn enemies, but yet we're selling them food. And I use the we just as a convenience. I don't mean like you and I mean U.S. government.
You mean I did it. I know.
We are not the government. The government is not us. But anyway, back to the movie. So these paratroopers come in and start shooting up the place, and they decide that, these kids all escape to this, like, sporting goods store that one of their dads runs and gets a bunch of camping gear and ammunition and supplies and head up into the mountains. Meanwhile, the rest of the town is taken over, and the colonel who's running things, he's like, all right, go to the local sporting goods store and find this form that all these people who own guns had to fill out. And that'll tell us which houses to go to go collect all the guns and who the troublemakers are.
Uh-huh.
So they want to strip the, the guns out of the people's hands. And then,
which would make sense. If you're an occupying house, you would want to disarm any resistance.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's why Hirohito didn't invade the U.S. or, I mean, even if he could have, he was like, there's going to be a gun behind every blade of grass. So, that's
more
an unwinnable
worse,
situation.
Yeah.
So anyway, the kids escape up to the mountains and they're up there for a few weeks and they don't really know what's going on. So they finally decide to head back down and see what is happening in town. And they return and it's under military rule.
Like martial law style.
Yeah, martial law. There's troops everywhere. People keep their heads down so they don't get in trouble. Anyone who's able-bodied or considered to be a potential troublemaker is brought to the makeshift concentration camp or re-education camp that's out by the drive-in movie theater, and they're playing all these propaganda films at them like, we're your friends. We're here to liberate you.
Nice.
All that kind of stuff. And
it's cute.
And, of course, there's summary executions, like a bunch of people just get lined up and shot to be made examples of. So what they're trying to do is disillusion people, break the morale so that they won't resist. And the teenagers come back down into town and see all this, and they see their dad in the re-education camp, and he's pretty beat up, and he's like, you know, avenge me, you know, kick their ass, that kind of a thing. And then they head back to the mountains. And once they're up there, and I don't recall if this happened before they came into town or right after, but there's this struggle within the group between the student body president guy and Jed, who's the Patrick Swayze guy, who, you know, Jed wants to, like, fight. He wants to resist. And the other guy, the USB president or ASB president, is the son of the mayor. And he's like, well, I want to go back to town. And, you know, my dad will know what to do. And we'll figure this out. We'll be okay. And Jed's like, no way, man. You know, you're free to go if you want, but I'm going to fight. And anyone who wants to stay and fight can stay with me, but you got to listen to me. You got to follow my rules. You're going to fight the way that I tell you to fight. And if you want to leave, you want to opt out right now, you can go.
Okay. So he kind of, you know, kind of makes a contract there.
Yeah. He's sort of homesteading his position as the leader of the wolf pack, if you will. And so, you know, anyone who wants to go is free to go, but they all end up deciding to stay.
Now, does he enforce his orders with violence against his own people?
No, it's mostly just tough talk. He and the ASB president do get into a little bit of fisticuffs, but then they make up and apologize to each other.
Okay. So the ASB president guy, he sticks with him or he takes off?
He sticks with him.
Okay.
But then an issue comes up later, which we sort of talk about. But before we get to that, essentially the kids decide that they're going to combat the Russians and Cubans with guerrilla-style tactics. So, like, they'll have one of the girls who's with them, like, ride into town and get harassed by some of the occupying soldiers. And they'll steal, like, whatever little basket she has, and they put it in one of their vehicles, and it blows up, killing a few of them, and then she runs away. They give chase, and out of these little hidey holes, everyone pops up and shoots the people chasing her.
Right.
And then you get the typical, you know, 80s montage of, though without, you know, fast-paced 80s rock music, of them doing a bunch of excursions or missions, you know, where they're disrupting things, blowing up transports and checkpoints, and they start spray painting Wolverines on things, which was their high school mascot. So they kind of adopt that as their name. And they start saying Wolverines like you've done a half dozen times already.
Yeah.
So
Wolverines after
Wolverines. So after a while, you know, they start getting enough success that they bring in a specialist to kind of hunt these guys down. And as part of that, they capture the ASG president, who has snuck into town for whatever reason, and they torture him and then put a homing device or a tracking device. They make him swallow it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leads the Russians to the Wolverines. And then there's a battle, and a couple of them get killed or injured, something along those lines. This is kind of loosely remembering this. And let's see, if they put a tracking device in him and then they let him rejoin
and this guy knows he has a tracking device in him.
He does. Yeah.
And he willingly goes back to the group.
Yes.
He's like, he knows he's leading these Russians back to the Wolverines.
Right.
Because he wants to warn them or because he wants them to be killed by the Russians.
Well, he goes and doesn't tell them that he's leading the Russians to them.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. That's hard to say. I mean, I assume it's because he was tortured or told that if he told them that something bad would happen to him or his family, something along those lines. I'm sort of speculating here.
They still have his family.
Yeah, like his dad was the mayor, and he's sort of this puppet mayor at this point. You know, but
so
still a figure for the townspeople to like look up to and think is the figurehead still.
So would you say that he's making a moral decision here, or no, he's acting under duress?
Well, certainly getting caught and tortured and then forced to swallow this device, that's involuntary. That's under duress.
Right.
But then going back and not informing the people, the Wolverines, that he has this device on him, mm-hmm. I think that's a voluntary decision.
They didn't say, hey, you go back to the Wolverines, or else we're going to kill your family or something?
Well, it's not made clear, but they do send him back to rejoin the Wolverines. And the Wolverines didn't even know he was gone, apparently. Because, like, when they discover that the tracking device, he's the one who's making it indicate, you know, like, as the tracking device gets closer to him, he goes beep, 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 like he's the guy. Then he confesses.
What's beeping?
A portable radio triangulation device that the Russians used.
The Wolverines have?
No, the Russians. The Russians who are using this radio device to track the homing device that Daryl had to swallow, the ASP president had.
Okay, so the Wolverines are hanging out in their bunker or whatever, and then these Russians, like these Russian commando guys, are closing in on their position, and something starts beeping?
Yeah, so the Russian guys are following the beeping, and the Wolverines are actually set in an ambush. Why, I don't know. Because they didn't know that they were being tracked, but perhaps that was just a state of readiness that they were in.
Okay.
But anyway, the Russians approach, and there's a firefight, and they kill most of the Russians, capture one of them, but then they get the tracking device, or the triangulation device, and they notice that it's leading them somewhere, and they question the captured Russian, like, what is this? What is this? Tell us. And he's like, fuck you, capitalist pigs, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And then they notice that the device is beeping faster as they get closer to the ASB president guy, the school body president guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's then that he confesses that, you know, hey, they tortured me and my dad turned me in and they have this device on me or made me swallow it. And then he starts begging for mercy. And Jed, the Patrick Swayze dude, he had already shot. He shoots the Russian guy,
mm-hmm.
and he's about to shoot the ASB president guy. But he's like, he can't really do it. You know, he's like struggling with this moral decision. And then one of the other Wolverines he saw his family get murdered right in front of him. And he's like super jaded and like kind of fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
He just shoots him. He shoots the ASP president guy. He's like, all right, that's over and done with.
Right. For this betrayal.
Yeah. For the betrayal.
Right. Now, my point was, and obviously this isn't how it was written, of course, but, to satisfy whatever emotional beats that the author wanted to provide. But it seems to me that it would have been a better idea because, I mean, you kill this guy and you got this tracker. I don't know if there's multiple tracking things that could track this tracker thing, probably. And you leave the guy there and then you just go off and go somewhere. If you had left him alive and said, you know, go another way, that would have been way better. You could have just totally thrown the Russians off your trail.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that would have been a much smarter move, a much more strategic move for them to do is, you know, lead them away from us. Yeah, and more moral. Lead them away from us until you poop this thing out, and then come find us.
Yeah. Right, because you swallowed it, right? I mean, eventually it'll pass through.
Yeah, and one would think.
Yeah.
Anyway, Most of the things I've swallowed have ended up on the other end.
Yes, so... So what happens after? Is that like the big climax of the movie, or what?
No, there's another big scene where like these Hind helicopters swoop down and are shooting them up and kills a bunch of the Wolverines, and you know they keep getting it's like a war of attrition. And one of Rothbard's points in his review, which will be posted down below, is that this resistance doesn't seem to gain any supporters when you know in any other situation it most likely would. And so mm-hmm. it seems rather hopeless unnecessarily because, you know, their numbers dwindle and dwindle and dwindle until there's only, you know, a handful of them left.
Yeah, so what is the, would you say that the takeaway is from the movie? Like resistance is futile? Resistance is righteous? What do you think the takeaway is?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of people argue that it's a pro-war movie. Rothbard thought it was more of an anti-state movie. And I'll leave it to the listener to decide, you know, read the review and watch the film yourself. I'm not sure exactly where I stand on it. They do seem to be pretty patriotic, nationalistic, you know, rah-rah, go USA.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, state versus state combat. And they happen to be individuals caught in the middle. And so they're sort of fighting to survive, but they're definitely choosing sides and they want to see the state that they had been ruled by to prevail. So I don't know. I kind of find his argument maybe less than compelling in that respect. But, you know, there are a lot of individual, rugged individual type ideas in the movie, and guerrilla warfare, which, you know, during revolutionary times was looked down upon. You know, you're supposed to, like, stand regimented in bright uniforms in a row and, you know, fire while the guys in front of you are reloading or whatever. And the whole reason that the Americans won is because they didn't do that bullshit. Like,
it's like,
fuck
this
that.
Stupid. This
we're going to flank you. We're going to hide. We're going to, you know.
We're going to shoot at you from the fucking, war is dirty. We're not going to fucking play by your dumbass rules.
Yeah, and by the way, thanks for wearing the bright red uniforms, idiots.
Right. If you had some bright yellow to help accent that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of a disjointed discussion about Red Dawn. I don't know. You have any more comment on that?
Yeah. So way back in the day when we first started talking, maybe, hey, we should probably do Red Dawn. Back before I understood, or it had been so long since I'd seen the movie, I didn't remember all the where the Russians just came in and started killing people and stuff like that. I was going more from a, I was looking at it more from like an occupational government. So if one government were to just, say, attack a country and only hit military targets and only kill political leaders and then just take over that, it seems to be that the acts of Wolverines would be far less justified because you're basically trading one set of rulers for another set of rulers that are essentially performing the exact same function. The only difference would be that these are new rulers that maybe look different from the old rulers. You could maybe argue that you're coming to the defense of another by protecting, like, your military friends or your politician friends, I guess, even though that's a disgusting thought. So from that kind of lens, the idea that, I mean, having one set of rulers or another set of rulers for your average person means kind of very little. I mean, just look at it from election standpoint. When one leader transfers over to another leader, I mean, when Bush got replaced by Obama, the policies stayed almost identical. Obama ramped up the drone strikes. But other than that, really, you know, the experience for your average American is essentially the same.
Well, the marketing was a little slicker.
Yeah, and he got the left cover for his wars, so all the anti-war people went away. So, because apparently we only hate it when Republicans carry out wars. We don't mind it when black people kill brown people. That's perfectly fine. So, I was looking at the movie from the lens of, you know, one regime change for another regime change, and the average common person going, Wolverines! Seems kind of disingenuous and strange to me. Because we don't get upset when political leaders are replaced with other political leaders. I mean, some people do, but I mean, realistically, well, your life doesn't change a whole lot.
Well, tell that to all the all the overreactors on Facebook right now who are all thinking that Trump's the next Hitler, you know?
Sure.
Like, to them, this changeover is a big deal, and they take Trump saying that he would question the results if they appeared to be shady. They're taking that as, well, he's not going to peacefully accept the transition to power, you know?
Right, because he accepts the fact that there is horrific corruption and fraud constantly in the election process.
Right. And it's funny how the leftists totally forget that there was all this controversy with Al Gore in 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that Kennedy won a disputed election that, uh-huh. You know, there's questions about whether that was legitimate or not. And even the Bernie Sanders thing just recently, you know, they're saying there's all this corruption and rigging against Bernie and the left was all over it. They're like, oh my God, this is so corrupt. This is so bullshit.
But
now they're like, oh, there's
Trump,
no corruption.
Yeah. Now
fine.
When Trump questions it, they're like, what are you talking about? Our peer system? I mean, maybe there's a few little problems, but no way. Are you kidding me? Look at this monster saying these horrific things. Yeah, things go down the memory hole so fast, and hypocrisy is so flagrant it's really hard to take any of it just without sadness. I don't know. That many Democrats kept saying that, you know, Bush wasn't elected. He wasn't a legitimate president.
Yeah, he's not my president.
Right.
And when people said that about Obama, you know, they got all upset and called him racist.
Yeah. There's no consistency there, especially with the left. But on either side of the political spectrum, they're constantly acting hypocritically. And as long as their team is the one that's winning, they don't seem to care that the whole system is rigged and whatever. And in reality, it's not your team. You get some favors, I suppose, from the oligarchs, but most of them are constantly working against the people, constantly feeding and sucking off and leeching off the people and throwing tidbits down to appease the masses. The political system works against you more than it works for you, even though it
is. And why anyone believes any of the politicking that goes on during campaigns, because they immediately reverse course once they assume power. You know, they break all their campaign promises.
Yeah,
and they change them on a whim, depending on, you know, whichever public opinion study was released that morning. You know, like Hillary says she's got a public opinion and a private opinion about everything. You know, it goes the same for all of them.
Yeah, and then once they're in power, do they give a shit about those anymore? I mean, even if it was legitimate. But, I lost my train of thought. Just complaining.
Well, you know, I want to bring it back to your original question, because you said it was interesting how it's this changeover of power, and so long as the civilians weren't attacked directly, they shouldn't really care.
Well, and, in the time of the American Revolution, the original Brexit,
well played, sir.
Well.
Brexit 1.0.
Like, yeah, what was it, like 3% fought in the revolution? Most people didn't care. Most people saw it as these few rich landowners cared. To most people's lives, it was changing one set of rulers for another. But go ahead. What was your point?
Well, I guess my point was that on a philosophical level, yeah, they shouldn't care. But in a reality level, pragmatic level, in boots on the ground level, they would care because of nationalistic pride and the propaganda that, you know, they're all part of, you know, Team A versus Team B, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, there's a very tribalistic way people have of thinking of us versus them. I agree. But from a very pragmatic, if you go even more pragmatically and go, well, how is my life going to change? It's not much different. Now, if you actually have boots on the ground shooting your friends in the face, of course.
Yeah, re-education camps, the whole, like, Red Dawn scenario is pretty horrific.
Yeah, that absolutely. Defend your friends. Defend yourself. 100%. I'm all for it. Group up for defense. Absolutely. But if you just had, like, some coup attempt or an assassination of a president and then LBJ is now president, I mean, was everybody up in arms? Was everybody crazy upset?
No, I think they covered that one up pretty well.
Right. But even though, I mean, he's definitely part of it. I mean, it just seems to me that you're constantly being sucked off of and stolen from and threatened by oligarchs. And whether they are from the Bush crime family or the Clinton crime family, it doesn't seem to be a whole lot of different, or maybe from the Putin crime family. I don't know. There are slight policy changes, and it's always getting worse. But I don't know. If you're going to be consistent, I think that, you know, all politicians would be killed the day they step foot into office, because they're constantly aggressing against people. They're constantly stealing from and threatening people. And how do people react when they're threatened or stolen from, when you're mugged on the street? You react defensively with violence. And it's perfectly legitimate. I'm not saying go out and kill politicians or anybody. I'm not saying kill anybody. But that if you're being consistent. Now, obviously, where the rubber meets the road is with the is with the the oligarchical enforcers as the police, and so that's where you see all kinds of clashes with the people because they're the enforcers. And some people do kill police, and a lot of times it's justified. Anyway, I think I kind of got off point there. I don't know what I was talking about.
No, that's totally fine. I don't think our listener or two really care what we say.
That's kind of
as long as it's, you know, about an hour long and covers the commute with something.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying go out and kill anybody. I do not argue for violence, as you should know by now. I've been listening to me, but it just seems to be that if you're making the argument that Wolverines are acting defensively in that situation, yes. But if you're making the argument that, you know, some sort of a regime change is somehow a threat or somehow a violence against you in order to act defensively, then it seems to be that bringing in any kind of foreign, you know, rulers is essentially the same as an election. You're just swapping out rulers. Am I making any sense? I don't even know. I've kind of lost my perspective. Libertarian.
Well, yeah, I think it makes sense. Like you're going to get a different set of rulers regardless of where they come from, and so long as they're not, you know, directly impacting you personally, aggressively, what difference does it make to you, you know, to quote Hillary Clinton?
That's kind of my point. That's a Hillary Clinton quote?
What difference at this point does it make? That's her quote when she was questioned on the reason that Benghazi was attacked, because she was claiming it was retaliation for some video that was posted to YouTube that it's upset ISIS people or something along those lines. It's pretty terrible.
Okay. Good. So anything else to do about Red Dawn? How does it end? Everybody dies or a couple people live?
So the Hind helicopters attack and kill a bunch of the Wolverines. And then out of the few remaining, a few of them decide to flee where Jed and his brother, Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen, attack the town and try to kill the leader of the communist attack, the occupying force.
And yeah, in this world, the Chinese are friends and they're not communist?
They are friends in this. At the beginning of the movie, assuming, you know, before the war, there's a million or a billion screaming Chinamen. And this is a quote, so, you know, don't get mad, folks. A billion screaming Chinamen. And one of the downed Air Force pilots recalls to the kids, you know, there's no one on our side except for the United Kingdom, and they're not going to last very long, and 600 million screaming Chinamen. And one of the people, one of the Wolverines says, last I heard there were a billion. He goes, there were.
But in this world, the Chinese are allies, and they're not communists?
Communist or not, there are buddies.
Okay.
They don't make
it
clear whether
there. There's a rift there between the Russians and the Chinese.
Yeah. And perhaps it's, you know, the struggle between, you know, our communism is better versus your communism.
Yep. All right.
Well, and, you know, the movie was made, you know, just 10 or so years, 12 years after Nixon famously went to China and opened up Red China and all this investment was happening at the time. So perhaps they didn't want to upset the Chinese at that time, though now I think the new Red Dawn has the Chinese as the invading force. So, you know, like fuck them now.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen the new one because it's not available without paying extra. Like it's not part of Amazon Prime or Netflix or anything. So I had intended to do a comparison contrast between the two. So sorry, folks, just getting the old one right now.
And I haven't seen any of them except for Red Dawn original and, you know, 20 years ago or something like that. Who knows?
Oh, back when it was relatively new. Okay. I mean, to 8-year-old me, this was an awesome movie. To, how old am I now? 30 years later?
Yeah.
Not as good. Not such a great movie.
But everything's better when you're 8. Like Christmas, Halloween, I mean, just everything. Birthdays. So, not surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I just perused Murray's review of it, and I got to the point where he mentions the libertarian moment in the movie. And it's at the end of the movie when Charlie Sheen and Patrick Swayze had infiltrated the town and killed one of the commanding officers. One of the level 2 commanders who was there initially, and then this senior person was brought in to like track the Wolverines. He's questioning whether he should be doing what he's doing. So he's writing a letter to his wife saying he's going to quit. He wants to go home. He was once a gorilla, and now he's fighting gorillas, and he's like, what's it all for? Now I'm just this policeman, and it's, you know, terrible. And so when Jed and his brother attack the town, the Russian commander guy sees Jed trying to escape the town carrying his brother who's been shot. And he has his gun and can shoot him, but in that moment he decides to just let him go. And he lets him escape, though he had also been shot. So Jed and his brother have both been shot, but they're able to escape the town or the area that they had attacked. And their last scene on this park bench where he's holding his Jed's holding his brother and telling him to, you know, keep fighting, stay alive. But then they cut to the very end of the film where there's this monument about, you know, hey, these teenagers fought to save this town and blah, blah, blah. So one assumes that they both died on this park bench after being shot.
But they inspired others and they fought back against their oppressors.
Yeah, and then the American forces eventually drive out the infiltrating occupying forces. And then a monument is made to the Wolverines.
I wonder how well this movie would go over if the Wolverines were all like Arabs and the invading army were Americans and then they played it in the United States.
Well, I mean, you could just look at like one of the Rambo movies where he's over there helping the Afghans fight the Afghanis fight the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that was early 80s. And that was freedom fighters fighting against the invading force Russians. And now it's like the same dudes fighting against the invading force, you know, U.S., and now they're terrorists.
I had something.
Aside from a really super long pause?
Well, no, it was a super long pause, and I was like, okay, this is good. This will get deleted automatically. But then I was going to come back in and say something smart, and then it didn't happen, and then I was disappointed. So, I don't know if the United States people are really comfortable thinking of their military forces as terrorists, which is, you know, what they are. I mean, war is mass murder, and you are essentially invading and terrorizing a population. Whether you agree or disagree that, you know, Saddam Hussein was a good person or whatever, you can make the same argument against any politician. At least I could. I was watching this movie last night called Gangs of New York, and Boss Tweed and Tammany Hall are kind of like big in it. And they were making the claim that Boss Tweed was like the most corrupt politician ever. Never seen again the corruption, the level of corruption ever again since Boss Tweed. And I was like, well, that's wishful thinking. I mean, I'm sure he was horrible, but to say that it hasn't been matched, I think is an incredibly subjective thing to say.
Yeah, I think if you ask anyone who's involved in the political spectrum right now, they'd say, well, the person running against my person right now is worse than Boss Tweed.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's funny, though, that in the documentary about the movie, which is like one of the bonus features, they talk about all the good things he did do. Like he built some courthouse and he built some museum and he, quote, gave people jobs. Now, when they say he gave people jobs, what they really mean is he handed out licenses to do a thing. So they restricted the number of people that could, say, butcher meat or drive a cab or name it, be a plumber, be a whatever. And,
cut people's hair.
Yeah, cut people's hair. They handed out these licenses. And they call that, and crediting that with giving people jobs. Fuck you very much. you're doing nothing but restricting jobs to people that pay you money or provide you with political favors or vote for you in some election or whatever. You have no right to declare who can and cannot do any given thing, as long as they're not aggressing against anybody else, and they wouldn't be. They'd just be providing a service. So that was really fucking annoying when they started talking about how Boss Tweet gave people jobs or how it just pissed me off. Anyway.
Well, that's cronyism in its finest. You know, it's favored political protection provided that you know, give them money or what have you. And it has nothing to do with giving people jobs or providing jobs. That'd be a voluntary thing. This is a restrictive thing, like you were saying. And it's just, you know, handing out favors to in kind, you know, like you give me money, I'll give you this piece of paper that says we won't harass you if
right.
you do something that you should be able to do anyway.
Right. That the market will decide whether you're good at it or not. Yeah, there was another really stupid fucking line in the fucking documentary. It was a History Channel documentary they put on the DVD. They said they were talking about the incredible poverty at the Five Points in New York City and the New York City boroughs in the 1850s and 60s and whatnot. And they said that, well, the poverty was terrible, but they finally got around to fixing it when they made a law that said that every building had to have windows in it. And I said, what the fuck are you talking about? First of all, things don't just happen because all of a sudden there's a goddamn law. You don't just poof windows into being because you wrote a law. You're essentially saying we're going to attack you and force you to install windows in places, whether you want one or not. It is so horrific. You don't just government doesn't just manifest things into existence by royal decree. Anyway, and then they talk about how that's like a wonderful thing and how government's wonderful because they can just poof things into existence by making laws for these things. It's like saying, I'm going to write a law that makes everybody rich. So all of a sudden, amazingly, everybody's rich. What?
Is that a Bernie quote?
No, but I'm sure he would if he could. I mean, why not, right?
Me of,
if government just poofs things into existence, why not do that, right?
Yeah.
Just write a law that says everybody's rich now. It's illegal to not be rich. And then every sudden, everyone's going to be rich, right?
How's the audio on your end? Sound okay?
You sound fine. I don't know if I sound
okay.
Fine. I don't know.
Yeah, you started sounding a little weird for a minute, but I think it's better now. So anyway, what you're talking about reminds me of an anecdote that Judge Andrew Napolitano uses in some of his speeches where he's talking about a guy who was defending himself against government prosecution. And he chooses to represent himself, and he says, you know, if Parliament decrees that the Earth is flat, a round Earth is flat, and the King determines that, you know, a flat Earth is round, does it change the shape of the Earth? You know, like their laws don't change the reality of the situation.
Right. Just because you write a law that decrees a thing doesn't just poof it into existence. So giving people credit, I mean, it's really what it says was is that people didn't have the money to have windows or they didn't value windows in these particular locations as much as they valued other things. But making a law that forces everybody to put windows in every window hole or what have you, I don't know the exact situation, but it doesn't automatically poof those things into existence at no cost.
Well, I guess I don't understand what even the premise is that they say that the windows eliminated poverty. Like, were they all glassmakers and they were now provided, like, additional work because windows were now needed?
Yeah, they just kind of glazed over it and just kind of said that this is a triumph of government because it was a really poor area.
You're a punny guy.
It's a really poor area. And then they just made a law that said that there are now windows. There had to be windows in buildings. And then everything's better. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't understand like how they're not poor now because they have windows or because they now had jobs making windows. I mean, are they like the, is it the Bastiat like broken window fallacy? Is it the Paul Krugman Keynesian, you know, alien invasion shit? Like, oh, let's pretend there's going to be an invasion and all this stimulus will happen and that'll end poverty.
Right. I don't know. Probably the second one more, but Yeah, I mean, it probably created some jobs for some window makers because people now had to, it now became you know, more onerous. They had to have a window in their building.
Then can I change your word created to misallocated?
You can. It would be because it goes against the people's preferences.
Yeah. Yeah, so some jobs, some investments were misallocated towards window production at the expense of something that was more desirable, but through coercion and force.
And therefore, government's awesome. Got rid of poverty. Super sweet. Either they ignore all the horrific licensing issues and all the other things that were basically making it onerous for people to enter the market and provide services for each other and create wealth. So government, you know, doesn't take the blame and then gets all the credit. It's awesome.
Pretty typical story, I would say. Seems to be the narrative in my Facebook feed these days. Government's great. Unless that person gets in control of it, then it's terrible.
Right. It's just how you use it. It's just a tool, and it just matters how you use it. If you use it for good, it's awesome sauce. If you use it for evil, it's evil.
Right. Yeah, and that other person is totally interchangeable depending on who you're supporting or whatever, you know, like the world's going to end if the other side wins.
Right. And it's always the most important election. This is the
But that's what's so awesome about the Trump thing, because it totally brings back the things that people in the alternative media were concerned about for years, was this ever encroaching additional powers, you know, like the Patriot Act and executive orders and whatnot, and all the left, like you were saying, is providing cover for Obama for the wars and the executive orders that are going on, saying, well, you know, he's a good guy, so it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're like, wait a minute, this Trump guy might get into power, and all those executive orders are on the books now, and oh shit, now he can do all that stuff.
Yeah, oh shit.
Well, no shit, dummies.
Yeah. And yet they don't see the horror of democracy. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't we segue over to the Steph stuff? We teased on that a little earlier. And, you know, I offered an opinion that I watched the video and I thought it was terrible. I didn't have the heart to go into arguments or the stamina to go into it. But you were sending me a bunch of stuff over IM. So if you're feeling fired up, you want to go there?
Well, what we can do is we can do this segment, and then if it's any good, release it, and if it's no good, cut it. So Stefan Molyneux, longtime guy I looked up to, you know, respected, really enjoyed some of his early stuff. Lately, he's been more of a, I mean, I used to really look up to him because he was a very principled guy. He was always, you know, arguing from first principles. And now he seems to kind of look back on that time of his and see it as, you know, he's grown from that. And now he's smarter and better, and he's more educated, and he knows more facts, and he has better reasoning. And so it's what it seems to me is he's just becoming more pragmatic. And he's like, well, I'm going to root for Trump because better than Hillary. And
the lesser of two evils deal.
Yeah, he's just making this lesser of two evils argument. But he's also making all these other horrific arguments. And let's get into it. So the video is called Why I Was Wrong About Libertarians. And he uploaded it yesterday, October 27th, 2016. And about 20 minutes in, the first like 20 minutes is him kind of talking about his contributions to libertarian thought, where he's talking about spanking and how he expected kind of the libertarian intelligentsia to kind of take his idea and run with it, and how disappointed he was with that.
And if I could interject, you know, I too looked up to Molyneux and still do in many ways, and he brought a lot of good information to light, and I take his, like we were alluding to earlier, or we even discussed earlier, the no spanking thing to heart. You know, I think that is very important, and whether academic libertarians or what have you don't pick that up and run with it, is, you know, I think he's looking at the lack of people picking it up, and he's disappointed by that. But I mean, it affected me. You know, I'm doing that, So right. I wouldn't say that he lost on that. I say that, you know, it's an important issue. He brought it up. No one else is willing to talk about it. And I'm glad that he did.
Yeah, and he's complaining that it hasn't been as enthusiastically accepted, I suppose, or he gave some talks at, like, Pork Fest or Freedom Fest or whatever, and he's saying that there's just been crickets. Well, maybe people aren't being as vocal as possible, but he has absolutely affected people's thinking, in my view. You know, he gets into the whole science of it, where spanking is shown to lower IQs. Well, that's great. Absolutely. For that reason alone, probably shouldn't spank. But also, it violates the NAP, and that's all you need to do to convince me not to do a thing, is essentially violate the NAP. It is hitting another person. It's attacking. It's initiating force against someone that can't defend themselves. It's
a smaller, weaker person who looks up to you for their nourishment and affection and raising and supposed, you know, like, maybe this is putting
well-being.
Too many words into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, like, you know, they don't know anything except the experiences that they have, you know, with you or, you know, while you're raising them. I'm not really saying this quite right, but, like, to break that bond of trust, to have this innocent child who is looking to you for everything, and then you turn around and inflict aggressive violence against them, I mean, that's got to fuck them up.
Yeah,
you know?
That's absolutely got to be a shock. And it's got to detach you and create that wall. You got to wall yourself off and kind of turn on that psychopathic brain where you are distancing yourself from that person. And that's got to hurt. That's got to hurt more than, you know, anything.
Yeah. I mean, I can just imagine my kids, you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old now. Like if I were to turn around and all of a sudden, like just start beating the shit out of them because they did something bad, it would harm
massive,
them so,
yeah,
be so much like
massive betrayal.
Yeah, and more than just the physical pain.
Sure.
I think it'd be emotionally scarring.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the point that Steph makes, which is an important point. You know, it's that betrayal. Like in Red Dawn, you know, the ASP president guy betrayed them, and they kill him for it.
Right.
Just to bring that back.
Right. So, what was I going to say? I was going to talk more about... spanking and the libertarian thought.
Well, we can keep it moving. I mean, he talked about a lot of stuff in the video.
Yeah. Okay. And so anyway, the title of the video is titled "Why I Was Wrong About Libertarians" or something like that. And he doesn't exactly identify who he's talking about. Obviously, he just says the word libertarians, and so. All we're left with is, well, I identify as a libertarian. I also identify as an anarchist, a voluntarist. Is he talking about the big libertarian party? Maybe. Is he talking about – at one point, he starts talking about what seemed to be some academics maybe at Mises University. But who knows? He doesn't mention anybody by name. So all we're left to do is kind of speculate, who's he talking about? So, yeah, the first 20 minutes, he's kind of complaining about the lack of his acceptance of ideas, which is fine. But then he starts getting into some really weird shit that I was just going, what the hell? So he starts talking about cops, and I think he makes some really bad arguments. In the past, he has made the argument that cops are kind of like these crime historians. And I was with him. You call the cops. They arrive after the crime has already happened. They try and figure out what happened. And then maybe they try and find, you know, the guy who did it or what have you. And go from there. Which is why it's always a good idea to be able to defend yourself. This time, he's making the argument that cops prevent people from getting killed. So right away, I'm going, wait a minute, this doesn't jive with what you said in the past. So I don't know if it's a situation where he is contradicting himself or he has basically saying that this new argument trumps the old argument. So that was
I'm totally
the
open
past.
To people evolving their thought. I've evolved my thought over time.
Sure. But it seems weird because this new argument is terrible. So if he's replacing this new the old argument with this new argument where – in the past, cops didn't really prevent crime. They don't really stop people from getting shot. They respond after the crime has already happened, essentially. They get there late. Now the new argument is cops prevent people from being shot all the time, and what they need is, in order to be able to do their jobs, is this kind of social support. And if you don't support cops, the blood is on your hands, and you are morally responsible for people getting murdered. Because cops aren't doing their jobs, since cops prevent crime, cops won't go into a neighborhood without some sort of me saying, go cops. Like a cop...
Like,
when he's,
like cheerleading?
Yeah, without me cheerleading, cops will just, they just won't take a call. Or they won't go into a certain neighborhood because there's nobody cheerleading from the sidelines. What? He's literally saying that the blood is on the hands of libertarians because libertarians aren't supporting cops and cops prevent people from being murdered. So therefore, libertarians are at fault for people being murdered by not cheerleading cops.
So what my inaction is a violation of some sort?
Yes. Your inaction is now a violation of the NAP, essentially. You are somehow morally responsible for the deaths of people by not doing a thing, by sitting at home and not writing a paper about how cops are great or something. I don't know. He's really kind of vague about it, but not really. He's almost overly specific in that he says the blood is literally on your hands because you didn't support a cop, so he decided to not do his job because somehow cops all of a sudden now stop people from being murdered. And I'm surprised that they do sometimes. But you can't have it both ways where cops are both mostly crime historians and also now mostly stop people from being murdered.
All right, so let's assume that he's evolved his thought. So now the new argument is what he means.
Okay.
Is there any way to justify what he's saying? Sort of like Murray used to say that government can only maintain its authority with the support of the people, and if enough people don't support it, it will fall apart. And so is that what Steph is arguing, is that for cops to do their job, which he thinks it does prevent some crime, and you know, in our previous discussions, we've had people say that without the government or police, people would just go around murdering people. It'd be anarchy in the bad sense. So, you know, in that sense, he may have a point if that statement were true. So I'm just trying to like flesh out if there's any substance to this argument or not.
Okay, so his argument is that cops are unable to do their jobs without popular support. Well, if that's true, that for anybody, because unless cops are a specific job, if cops aren't in a specific special job category, that only cops are the ones that need social support. If they're not, and just everybody needs some sort of special social support in order to do their job, then that can quickly break down. Because what is Congress approval rating? 3%, 5%? They clearly don't have popular support.
It's at least under 10.
What is the popular social support for assassins, yet they still seem to have jobs? People still get killed for money. What is the popular support for, I don't know, you name it. So do jobs still happen without popular support? Yes. But if you're talking about...
Or non-jobs, like actions, like things happen with or without popular support, right?
Right, crime happens. It doesn't have popular support.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be a job. It just needs to be a thing that happens, right?
Just an action that you take or not, right?
Yeah.
So, right, so crime is wildly unpopular. Murder is wildly unpopular. Yeah, it still happens. So this idea that you have to have social support to do a thing is ludicrous and idiotic, and it violates self-ownership.
Well, hold on. Because I think Murray has a point when he says that, and this is also a Larkin point, if people no longer believe in the false authority, then the government has no power. So that contradicts a little bit what you're saying, or at least you calling it ludicrous that without social support, something will or will not happen. Do you follow what I'm saying? Like, I think if no one respected the authority of the government, like...
Well, now, wait, when you say the word no one, now you're talking about individuals.
Taxes.
Are you talking about individuals?
I'm speaking in a group of individuals, which I know is a little bit sloppy, but essentially, if enough people defied authority, stopped paying taxes, stopped listening to the rules of government, then the government would no longer be able to function. And so the corollary to that is that some level of social support is required for something to remain viable or effective.
I see what you're saying, but I think that the more realistic thing is that there's money to pay a cop to do a thing. If the money doesn't exist, sure. If people stop paying taxes and the money dried up, yeah, cops would find something else to do. They'd find another job. Politicians would maybe find a productive thing to do. Sure. But as long as there's somebody willing to pay a cop to go do a thing, that's all you need. All I need for me to do a thing is for someone to pay me. You don't need social support, whatever that nebulous term is. You need a one person to pay your salary.
All right, so let's break it down to you and me right now. We're doing this podcast. No one's paying us.
Right.
We're still doing it.
Yeah, because I enjoy it. So I am getting paid.
Cops, that's true, Payment is not necessarily monetary. It is satisfied wants and needs. Or satisfied wants and desires. Yeah.
Right. But would you continue to work at your job if you didn't get paid?
Highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. Highly unlikely. Would cops continue to put their lives at risk and go and assault people and aggress against people all the time if they weren't getting paid?
Now that's a bit of a loaded question. You say put their lives at risk, and I know that's the popular conception, but isn't it true that it's not even in the top, like, 50 or 100 most dangerous occupations? Like, isn't it overblown thing? That is true,
but anytime you point a gun at somebody, you're initiating violence. And anytime someone gets a gun pointed at them, they have the right to defend themselves.
Right, though they don't, usually, because they'll end up
dead. We're a nation of bootlickers, right?
Right, right.
Or pragmatic people that want to live a day.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
Right. Anyway, we're kind of getting off topic a little bit. But anyway, so he's basically claiming that if you're against cops, you're pro kids getting murdered. And
the blood's on your hands, therefore you are guilty of something.
Yes, you are guilty of people getting murdered by not publicly supporting people doing a thing, apparently. Not aggressing.
Yeah,
or whatever.
So your inaction is committing a crime. Now, this reminds me of the last episode of Seinfeld where some fat guy was getting picked on.
Right, the Good Samaritan class, right.
Yeah, and they didn't intervene, so therefore they were guilty of something.
Right, right. So, yeah, because you didn't do a thing. You had some sort of positive obligation. So Steph is basically making an argument against, you know, for positive obligation, and he's making an argument against self-ownership. So this completely goes contrary to everything he's done in the past, and it just makes me wonder where this is coming from, or is he just getting so sloppy and he doesn't realize what he's doing? Or is he
because a positive obligation is a positive right, right? It's a right of others to expect something from you.
Yeah. Cops are now have a right to expect popular support, whatever that even means, from everybody, or libertarians, I guess.
It's a bizarre argument. And I think we've tried to understand it and failed.
I think it's just a terrible argument. I think he's just either getting sloppy or he has completely divorced himself from any kind of logic and reasoning or understanding of the NAP and its implications. I don't know.
He
should know better. He understands self-ownership, and he shouldn't be making these idiotic arguments.
All right, so that argument set aside, let's open it up for comment from any listener. We want comment on this. Help us understand maybe in how this is justified. And then, Robert, let's move on to one of the other assertions that he makes in his video.
Right. Then just before we finish up with that, at some point he says that libertarians are mindlessly opposing cops, when I think libertarians are principally opposing cops. And I think that most people have many, many good pragmatic and practical reasons to oppose cops. Anyway, moving on.
He's certainly making a value judgment there and sort of deciding for a collective group as a whole who apparently all think alike. So that's kind of commie. You're in this class, therefore you must all think alike.
All libertarians mindlessly oppose cops. It's a strange statement to say.
Since they violate the non-aggression principle using stolen funds as their payment.
You can't possibly
not
have
to
a
say
reason.
That. Not to say that in Kapistan, in a free market society, private property society, there would be likely, I don't know for sure, there would likely be DROs, you know, defense agencies, defense resolution, or what is it, dispute resolution organizations, or police-type functions.
Yeah, DROs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in fact, Ed Stringham brings a good point in that if you add up all the cops in the U.S., and all the private security in the U.S., the private security outnumbers the number of cops by some huge margin.
Indeed.
I don't have the stats in front of me. People can look it up. Ed Stringham, he's pretty good.
Okay. So then he kind of moves on to his recently he's done some episodes, at least one episode I think I heard, where he talks about biodiversity of human beings. And he had, like, some kind of specialist on that was talking about the IQ of different people. And he's basically saying that, you know, people in the Middle East have the average IQ of, like, 70 or 80 or something like that. He was actually talking to an Iranian. And he was saying how, well, you came over here to the United States because you wanted to get out of this backwards country. And you're just making things worse by you know, making a big brain drain, basically, and ensuring that, you know, all these dumb people are just going to be horrible to each other always for forever or whatever like that. That's kind of...
Because this was one of the smart people who left? Is that what he's saying?
Yeah. Now, he wasn't saying that he wasn't blaming the person for wanting to get out of there. But he was saying, well, having, you know, not staying and fighting to make it better, you're essentially guaranteeing that it'll be worse, I guess. He's making odds.
Oh, okay.
Anyway.
It's a vaguely familiar argument, like the people who would, you know, leave an area that is going down the shitter are going to be the people capable of leaving, you know, the people with the means and the intelligence and the spirit to do it.
Right. So he starts talking about, I pulled this quote directly from what he said. You can't have a democracy unless you have at least an IQ of 90 in the general population. So he said that Iranians and Iraqis, since they're too dumb, that it's just impossible to have a democracy because a democracy, for some reason, is somehow good. And my translation of that is to say that he would say the people in Iran are too dumb to be ruled by a tyranny of the majority. Instead, they prefer a tyranny of the minority, or something like that. But it's a strange argument to make, saying that you're just too stupid to have a democracy, and let's see here. He's saying that if more libertarians had come out and say that, well, it's dumb, it's futile to try and spread democracy around the world to the Middle East. If more libertarians, because he's talking to libertarians, if more libertarians had said that, then there wouldn't have been a war, because the people in charge would have been, oh, well, this is a futile endeavor. The people over there are just too stupid to have a democracy. Well, then let's not even try, because that's what war is about, right? War is about spreading democracy. It's not about the military-industrial complex. It's not the food for the state. It's none of that. Is Stefan really buying into the argument that – is he buying the propaganda that war is about spreading an ideology?
Well, I'm going to let you finish, but – you know, there's also oil as a consideration.
Sure. Wars are about natural resources and sucking off the people of your own country and giving no-bid contracts to your cronies. I mean, wars happen for a myriad of reasons.
Yeah, it's the health of the state.
It's the health of the state. So to say that it's just about spreading ideology, and if more libertarians had come out and made the point that Iraqis are just too stupid, then the war wouldn't have happened. He's basically making an argument that since you didn't do a thing, you didn't come out and say that Iraqis are too dumb, that the war happened, and therefore more blood is on your hands, libertarians.
All right, if I may respond.
Please.
Unless you have more.
No, it was just baffling. It's just a baffling argument. Go ahead.
Okay. So I think that there's a kernel to what he's saying that I'll try to understand or try to articulate. And that is that you can't just create a vacuum and expect a voluntary society to take its place, like the Somalia example. Like, those people are not, and that sounds super racist, I know, but they are not people who are likely to be informed about voluntary society, libertarian ideas, the NAP, Austrian economics, etc. You know, they're living day to day with these competing factions trying to become the next government. And so the population sort of needs to be in a position to where they've satisfied many of their basic needs so that they can focus a bit on learning these types of things. And so you can't just remove a certain situation and expect a voluntary society to just spontaneously appear, I think is what he's trying to say.
If that is what he's trying to say, he said it incredibly poorly. Because what I heard, and I believe what he actually said, was that you can't bring democracy, which is, as you well know, as far away from a voluntary society as there is.
Right, but in a relative situation to what it is right now in those areas, it's an improvement.
Well, they have dictatorships and monarchies.
All right, and the monarchy is maybe not, in the Hoppian argument, a monarchy actually has a stake in a long-term view of that geographic area.
Yeah,
versus
they have to
get
in the game.
I'm in charge for 4 years, 8 years, I'm going to just pillage.
Yeah, just the looters to get in and get out. I understand that argument. But that's not what Steph is saying. Steph is saying, you know, they're too dumb to have a democracy, to even have a democracy, to go in and have a propped-up U.S.-led democracy. That's what he's saying. Because he was talking specifically about the Iraq War, the U.S.-Iraq War, where U.S. went in, they killed Saddam Hussein, and they set up a puppet government. And then Steph is saying, dumb idea, because they just won't get it. It won't work. Democracy won't work there like it does here. Whatever kind of fucked up argument that is. He's making like some minarchist argument, kind of.
Yeah, so he's
arguing that democracy is good.
Maybe in a relative sense, like I was saying. Maybe it's better than what they have now, though
you
debatable if it's a monarchy.
Twice a week instead of three times a week?
Exactly, Walter Block. but I want to bring it back to his attacking in a verbal sense. Libertarians in that they didn't vocalize their lack of support for this because the Iraqis were too dumb. In my mind, libertarians have been predominantly anti-war. And back when Bush was persecuting said war, Bush 1 and 2, that the left was also saying no to the war. And it was a big stink. It was a big deal. And it still happened.
Yeah.
So whether libertarians who were likely anti-war to begin with were involved or not, the war still happened despite the left being totally against it. So what's his point?
Yeah, I don't understand. The idea that all it would have taken were some libertarian authors to write papers about the futility of establishing a democracy in Iraq, and then the war wouldn't have happened, ignores all the other myriad reasons wars happen. And ridiculously puts blame on people who are absolutely anti-war, saying that, oh, you're not anti-war in this one little also respect? Idiotic. I'm totally 100% anti-war, but you're also not anti-war in the idea that people are dumb over there. What?
Yeah, and what's funny to me is the contradiction in that all it takes for cops to do their job is support from libertarians, but all it takes for democracy to be improved upon is libertarians to not be anti-war, but to be anti-war because of low IQs in a certain geographic area.
This is the new Stefan Molyneux. This is the new thinking of this man. He seems to be going way out on a limb defending his positions.
What is his position?
Who knows?
He seems to be on a pro-Trump bent, and in a way, I am also intrigued by a Trump presidency just to see what happens.
Yeah.
And that sounds a little weird coming from an anarchist.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think
he's definitely the
anti-establishment
guy that hasn't taken a bunch of special interest money. I mean, there's something to be said. As stupid in his ideas are, and his economic ideas are.
And they are terrible.
And they are, and his horrific technocracy ideas. Like, we're just going to do everything smarter. We're just going to get the best people in to rule the best. As horrific as that is, I would rather have the Murray Rothbard morons that can't find a door handle in government. Not that I necessarily want people that can't find a door handle with their finger on the nuclear button.
Bush was in there, right?
He was. I mean, and again, we're arguing about the puppets. You know, I mean, these people aren't necessarily all the people that are really behind everything, but...
Yeah. Now, what about the Wenzel argument where he's like, if Hillary gets in there, she won't get anything done. She'll be, under subpoena and, what's the thing they do to, presidents? They impeach them. She'll be under investigation and impeachment, and she won't be able to get anything done. And she's not a people person. No one really likes her, so she won't be able to like ram things through. She won't get the popular support. Whereas Trump, he's a charismatic dude, and people will follow him, and he can get a lot of stuff done. And he's not principled, and he doesn't have really a good economic sense. And so he'll do some stupid shit and get people to support it. And so he can actually get some things done that could be very detrimental.
See, I think that's an old argument from Wenzel. Honestly, I don't think I think he made that argument before the real collapse of the Republican Party, the real collapse and where everybody is coming against this guy. Not only is every Democrat and every liberal person in the country against the guy, but also most of the people in his own party. I think if he got into president, he would hardly find anything, any kind of support to do anything.
I think Wenzel was saying that the people, the popular support, the same thing that Molyneux's talking about cops, is what would propel him to be able to accomplish things, despite the establishment.
Maybe. I don't see it happening, but maybe.
Unless I'm missing something. I mean, I still read Wenzel's website, and I haven't noticed a shift. From what I understand, he still says that both Hillary and Trump are equally horrific and terrible. It's just that Hillary will be inundated with all these issues, investigations and impeachment and all these things, and that's great because her attention will be on those things versus, her progressive agenda. Whereas Trump won't really have those issues, and he has popular support.
But will she? Will Clinton be subpoenaed and all that crap? I mean, she's been managing to quash every serious attack against the Clinton crime family for decades. I mean, she should be in jail for a dozen different reasons.
She does have a good track record of that, yes.
She's like a Teflon Don. Nothing seems to be able to stick to these guys. So I would be surprised if she actually was, impeached and all that. I think she's going to get way more done because she's got this left cover. And she's got the woman cover. She's got that feminist
cover. Yeah, and if you don't vote for her, you're a sexist, right?
Right. So I see it the other way around, honestly. I think Trump is embattled. Everybody hates him. He might have some popular support from whatever, 30%, 40% of the country, whatever. But I see Clinton as the establishment candidate, the just getting all the greased wheels. I mean, Obama has essentially done whatever he wanted for the past 8 years. It's possible that she'll have a slightly more difficult time, but it seems like it's just going to be a horror show. I mean, she wants to put a no-fly zone over Libya.
It's surprising to me that things aren't worse with the blank check that Obama's basically had for 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah, he has essentially things are really bad. I mean, not necessarily just here, but he has bombed the shit out of Libya and all these places. Drone strikes everywhere. And that's just, tiny parts of it. I mean, all the spying. I mean, I don't want to get into all the crimes of Barack Obama. We could be here all day, but
yeah. Now, an interesting, and this could be a whole new episode, is are the crimes of Obama actually crimes if he only ordered them to be done versus committing them himself? Because everyone has free will and voluntarily chooses to obey the order or not. And this is a discussion that's been happening in the Tom Woods group. If you hire an assassin or a hitman, is the hitman ultimately responsible? I argue that both parties are to blame, but a lot of people have said that it ultimately comes down to the person who pulls the trigger.
Yeah, and I'm more on the side of the person who pulls the trigger. I think what essentially it adds up to as bad advice. And if people would actually act their own conscience, because you can, it is just a job, right? When you're in the army, and not when you're in the army, when you're in the military, you have to follow orders or else they fucking attack you. But up the chain, when you're in the political sphere, someone tells you to do a thing, you can just say no, and you can just quit, right? You can step down from office at any time. When you're in the military, that's different. That is coercion, absolutely. You voluntarily sign on if you weren't drafted, but you voluntarily sign on. But once you're in there, if you say no, I don't want to violate my conscience, they'll throw you in jail.
Now, isn't a conscientious objector like a thing, or is that only related to the draft? Because I don't really know. I mean, do people, once voluntarily in there, can they decide to leave?
No, then you go AWOL, and you're a deserter, and they can kill you, which happens a lot, which has happened a lot in the past.
Okay. All right, well, let's roll back to some stuff, because I want to tackle a couple more of his arguments, then we can wind this up, because I think we've been going probably episode length so far.
Yeah.
But let's hit a couple more and then wind it down.
Okay, well, one fun part was when he compared libertarians to social justice warriors. He said that libertarians are in that crowd and conform with that crowd. And I was like, excuse me? What the hell are you talking about? I see social justice warriors on YouTube, and I'm horrified. And nothing but libertarians and anarchists make videos about how horrible social justice warriors are. I mean, if you've watched any kind of Anarchy Ball videos or all kinds of videos on YouTube, like That Guy T, make videos all the time about how horrible social justice warriors are. So I'm not exactly sure who he's targeting right there, who he's talking about, but it can't be all libertarians.
Yeah, what do you think he means by that, like in a nuanced way? Like, if what he's directly saying doesn't make sense, like, what do you think he's implying?
I wish I could understand it. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure exactly what kind of behavior he's comparing us to them as doing. Because social justice warriors, they want to use the violence of the state to get a thing that they want, to people to be nice to them or to grant them a service or to make it so that the bad man goes away or that the bad idea is out of their safe space. Or
like that professor who they wanted to have them refer to them by some pronoun that was Shakespearean, and they were complaining that they were denied housing for whatever reason because they were trans or what have you, and that was like a big deal.
Right, and she's saying how, yeah, there needs to be a law to prevent that when it's just somebody's preference if they don't want to rent to you, and you can't force somebody to rent to you, even though under law there are. I mean, there's all kinds of laws apparently. We were just talking about that recently with the domestic violence housing law and how people are forced to rent to certain people whether they want to or not. And I'm sure social justice warriors want language or verbiage in laws saying that you can't discriminate based on X, Y, or Z of whether or not you're going to associate with a person or not. And the libertarian, the anarchist, the freedom lover says, fuck you, freedom of association. If I don't want to hang out with you, I don't have to. If I don't want to provide a service to you, I don't have to. How is that in any way like a social justice warrior? It seems that the two things are diametrically opposed.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe one of the people who follows Steph and understands what he's talking about can give us maybe some exploration on this so that it makes more sense, because I don't see it. I don't see what the argument is from his standpoint.
Yeah, I don't. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time on it. He just makes that claim and then moves on. He doesn't really explain himself. And then the end of the video, he basically continues to rail against teachers, essentially, tenured professors in like the Mises Institute and other tenured professors around the country, and how that they're not actually, they're free market advocates, but they don't actually work in the free market.
Right, they're not living their principles. Like,
right.
They're the fat person who writes a diet book and expects people to take the diet book seriously, which
right.
is a totally pragmatic argument. I mean, he should know better than anyone that you don't take the messenger per se over the message, you know?
Right.
The message may be totally correct, and to judge it by the person who authored it or the, you know, the book by its cover, if you will, doesn't negate the arguments. It certainly is an indication that that person doesn't follow their own advice, so therefore hypocritical, which, you know, many people are hypocritical.
Right. If I were to say, you know, if I were to make an argument about, you know, like the black experience or a woman's experience, sure, you might say, oh, that's kind of weird, a white guy making an argument like that, but that doesn't negate my argument. How about look at the argument based on its own merit?
Right. And the corollary to that is, well, you're white, so therefore you can't talk about this experience.
That's just
shouting down
right
opinion, you know?
Right. Now, from his pragmatic, you know, time argument, I agree. We all do have a limited amount of time in the world, and how you choose to spend it, you make, you know, judgment calls. You discriminate. You profile. And if you see somebody who, a fat guy who's written a diet book, you're going to probably not read that book. But that doesn't negate and invalidate the book itself. So
it might make it less popular, like fewer people will read it because they will use the cover or the author's rotundity as a gauge on whether they want to read it, right?
True.
So it may affect their sales and profitability, but you're right, the arguments themselves would be the same in either case.
Right. So, I mean, I like his argument. I think that's one of his better arguments in the video, for sure. It is kind of odd that all these free market advocates aren't out in the free market. But
there are a fair number of them that are.
Sure. Sure. Like, Wenzel and Rockwell and Woods, those guys.
Yeah, but they're not tenured professors. I mean, maybe like Woods was at some point, I think, but now he's out on his own.
Yeah, he may be talking about Block. I don't know. He never mentions anybody by name. So it's hard to say. All you can do is when he talks about tenured professors, all you can say is, well, am I a tenured professor? No. Okay. Well, maybe he's not talking about me. But
right. But then also, you know, maybe Block considers in his subjective opinion that the position that he holds, he'll have the greatest effect in promoting the ideas of liberty and economics, similar to how Ron Paul was in the Congress and likely determined that that was his best avenue in advocating these ideas.
Right.
You know? And who's deaf to say that Block's or Paul's subjective opinion of their best route to promote their
the idea, yeah, is the best.
Is false or incorrect.
Right. Yeah, he's making a severe judgment call there on their avenue of attack.
Now, are we misstepping in that both of their positions are violating the NAP, Block and Ron Paul? Because in a way they are.
Yeah. Well, I would say that they are. They're using stolen funds, right?
Yeah.
Although I don't know if Paul ever accepted a salary. I could be wrong about that, but I think I remember him never accepting a salary. I could totally be wrong.
Sounds vaguely familiar, and I'm sure one of our two listeners will know the answer to that.
I'm sure the answer is a Google search away, but we can do that later. But that's about all I had for the video. Did you have some more thoughts or ideas? Because he ends it with a defense of Trump and a calling out of the professors. I can't remember what else he did, if anything.
Yeah,
that note.
You know, I think that hits most of it. I mean, my biggest gripe was that he seemed to group libertarians all together and collectivize their thoughts as if they're one unit, and therefore they must think this way. So that was a bit of a stretch. And it was hard for me to hear a self-proclaimed anarchist who says statism is dead and violations of the NAP are inappropriate to then promote Trump. Though I kind of understand the pragmatic argument that he feels lesser of two evils is Trump, yada, yada. But, you know, like we've said before, that's not really a great argument. And then to sort of divorce himself from libertarian thought when all libertarian thought is the NAP, when you really break it down. I mean, sure, there's different factions of things who have misunderstandings of what libertarianism is, but when it really boils down to is the NAP. So, you know, Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, not libertarians at all. They just happen to be running for the Big L Libertarian Party.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think stuff's kind of lost his way. I watched the video. I found it hard to watch, hard to listen to. And not because, you know, it was like exposing all these difficult truths, but that it seemed incorrect. Like his arguments were lazy and collectivized. And he's attributing a lot of subjective values on other people.
Yeah, yeah. He seemed to be projecting all kinds of attributes and arguments onto libertarians, whoever that is.
Right. And imposing positive obligations on them. And
left and right.
And arguing for positive rights and arguing that inaction resulted in violations of the NAP. So,
and against the self-ownership. He was
all over
the place.
Denying self-ownership.
Yeah, and that's so against his older stuff. And it seems to be that if this is the new stuff, then I can't – I mean, he's obviously divorcing himself from libertarianism. Okay, so we can't call you that anymore. Are you even an anarchist anymore? I know he calls himself that, but these arguments certainly don't seem to be consistent with any kind of anarchic position. Positive rights, non-self-ownership, all this crap. How is that in any way consistent? Yeah, so I don't even know what we want to call him anymore, but RIP Stéphane Molyneux, the libertarian or anarchist, I don't know.
Yeah, and again, we welcome comment from people, and I will say, and we opened this whole segment with, we feel like Steph had many positive contributions to our own development. He had a lot of good arguments. The spanking thing is really good. I follow that. I think the circumcision thing is important and something positive that he's created or pushed. But I think he falls down on lazy arguments in this, and he's sort of just name-calling.
Yeah, it seems like his feelings were hurt, and he's kind of like lashing out at anybody who's ever called him out for his divergence from freedom, really. I don't know. He does do a show every day, like for 3 hours, and he talks to a lot of different people, and I know he's been exposed to a lot of different ideas, and he has changed his mind on a lot of things, but it's kind of strange. And he even takes a stab. I don't know if he's taking a stab at principles, but he keeps mentioning over and over again the reason and evidence and how he's more open to reason and evidence and you need to be open to reason and evidence, as if we aren't. Then you – I forget what he said, but – he was basically just on his like high horse, talking about how smart and educated and how much knowledge he had and how reasonable and how much evidence he looked at and how other people didn't. And it really seemed – it just really felt condescending.
Yeah. And, you know, I've had issues with the reason and evidence thing because that goes back to the, well, my study says this and your study says that and, you know, we're never going to agree.
Yeah.
It's that scientistic approach, you know, and human action is not a controlled study. You know, there's so many variables. It's even more variables in the weather and voluntary interactions. I mean, demonstrated preferences can't be determined ahead of time. You know, people change their minds moment to moment. Different value scales are in place. New information's always happening. So to rely on just reason and evidence, which is what he seems to argue for, I think misses a very important area.
Yeah. Would you lump reason in with principles? I don't know. Is he doing that? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's not to say that you and I, well, speaking for me specifically, have all the answers. I clearly don't. I still have many questions that I'm still trying to figure out in my own mind. You know, so I don't have all the answers. And, you know, and I think that's one of the aspects of a voluntary society is that nobody, no one person or group of people can know what all the answers are going to be.
That's right. There's no such thing as perfect knowledge, which is why central planning will never work. We'll always be more inefficient.
Yeah.
As well as...
Well, that's really all I've got on the staff thing, and we can start winding this down unless you've got anything else you want to add. I know that
go ahead. No, I wanted to reiterate just how shocked kind of I was. I mean, I had seen his kind of divergence, and I know Larkin has mentioned in a few of his Steemit posts and on a couple of videos, and a few other people have... I think Katie Chaos has mentioned a few things about just how Stéphane is kind of going away. I don't know how else to put it, but just how he's turning away from principles and more towards this kind of statist argumentation style where it's all about the numbers and the evidence of some study, like you said, or what have you, and away from trying to apply the NAP, you know, principally and universally and that sort of thing. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hope that this podcast has presented some arguments or refutations to arguments. And by the way, Steph was making positive claims, therefore it's incumbent on him to prove his claims, and he failed to do so in many cases. Because, you know, I provided a very quick summary review of saying I listened to the whole thing and I thought it was terrible, and then people were saying that's not an argument. And I said there will be arguments aplenty in the podcast. So I hope that we satisfied that. And like I said before, we're open to comment. We're open to clarifications if you have them. You know, again, we don't have all the answers, but we watched this video, each of us, and we had visceral reactions to it, questioning a lot of the things he was claiming. And many of them on their face don't appear to be true when you apply principles.
That's right. But yeah, like we said, we're open to anybody that wants to further clarify his positions or defend his positions or explain his profession. Just, he seems to be moving towards a more of a status mindset, which is really weird. I still consider him some sort of an ally, I suppose, but I definitely don't look to him for the pure principled approach when it comes to discussing something. It seems to be more of a numbers and pragmatic argument style with him these days. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations where you kind of see someone who's gone full boat anarchist and then backtracks and goes the other way, which seems to be a rare thing. You know, like people who claim they were Misesian or Rothbardian at some point and then go back the other way. It's hard for me to fathom it, and I haven't seen a good reason to do it. It seems to violate many of the core principles, and, you know, maybe I'm the dummy. I don't know.
No, I saw the comments in the Steph video were people saying that they used to be libertarians and now they're ex-libertarians. I think that those are really people that are looking at things, you know, from a very, like, they weren't looking at things from a principled approach that didn't satisfy them for whatever reason, and prefer to look at things from a more pragmatic approach. Like, there was one lady who didn't think that life would work in Libertopia because people were too dumb. Because people would have to be, you know, are bad consumers. They just fall prey to whatever's in their food and whatever. And my response to that is, well, that just incentivizes people for becoming a better consumer. If you don't have this nanny state telling you that X, Y, and Z is good for you, you're going to take a little bit more time. You're going to maybe look for a company that is going to evaluate that thing better. These objections that apparently come from ex-libertarians, I don't know, they all seem bad to me. But maybe, like you said, maybe I'm the dummy, and maybe I'll see the light in a couple of years, and then I'll look back at my time as being a libertarian and go, what was I thinking? But I don't think so.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the other things that Steph said, and I know this is a long and winding episode, it's super long already, but he said that he had shunned political action in the past, and now he's back thinking that political action is okay. And that, you know, that one's a tough one for me because of the Ron Paul scenario and because Murray was rather politically aware and, you know, he thought political action was okay. I think you had told me the other day that you saw that Spooner was, even though, you know, he didn't believe that government was valid or that the Constitution applied, he would still vote, I guess, in a defensive way. So political action was still a thing for him. And
well,
so maybe there's something to that.
To be clear, Spooner and Woods' positions, as I understand them, is Spooner, he said he didn't begrudge the slaves from trying to affect their world in any way they possibly could. In Woods' argument, he sees it as a very pragmatic thing, as why wouldn't you use one of the tools of the oligarchs if the oligarchs are going to give you this tool to somehow affect change. But my argument is, and I've got many arguments against voting, but how illusory the act of voting is in addition to being the initiation of force, because your vote is not a request. It's not a suggestion. It's a command, and the effects of that vote are commands. But how illusory it is, how little it actually does, when the most it does is reinforces the idea in your mind that anybody has the right to rule over you. Every vote is a request for subjugation. It's a request to be dominated.
And it's also social support.
Absolutely.
Right?
There you go. Social support. It's social support. Every vote for a politician is telling that politician, yes, there's another person that wants me to rule them.
And they therefore agree with everything in my platform.
Right.
Every lie I've said.
Right. So I say walk away. Walk away and give them no power. Stop talking about them as if they could solve a problem. Stop talking about it as if they're in any way legitimate, as if they have any right to rule over anybody. So, yeah, I know Spooner, you know, he mostly, in his No Treason book, is basically what I'm talking about. I highly suggest everybody read it. It's fantastic. He's mostly talking about how the Constitution is not a valid contract and how the government is basically a gang of crooks, a successful gang of crooks. Those are his main, I would say, key points in that. In one section, he does talk about voting and basically what I said. But I think that if he were alive today, I would have a wonderful discussion with him. And I think he might probably, in the spirit of his writing, probably tend to agree with me. But I could be wrong. He might defend that to his death. I don't know. But I don't know. He's a brilliant guy. Super good book. And so is Woods. Everything he does is fantastic. Except I think he should be a little more principled in his ideas about voting, and go after people a little bit more. But I'm not going to criticize the man. He's put out so much content. It's incredible.
Yeah, and he's a pretty humble guy. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't begrudge him. I think he's making many, many contributions.
Absolutely.
And like I said before, you know, if we can argue from principles and still have disagreement, we're on to something interesting. And I think that's, you know, where we're splitting hairs on things and running through scenarios that are, you know, if the gorilla smashes the window, who's responsible? Is it the gorilla? Is the owner of the gorilla? Is, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and like you said, when you were watching that Larkin Rose video recently with the good anarchist, bad anarchist video, it's cool to see people trying to be the most hardcore anarchist, the most hardcore freedom lover. It's heartening when... it seems like it'd be counterproductive to have all this infighting, but I think it's actually productive in that we're all still trying to figure it out. Nobody's perfect on everything.
Yeah, hone your argument.
Yeah, hone your arguments, sharpen your tools, and then everybody's trying to affect change as best they know how. And, I mean, we obviously haven't figured it out 100% yet because we still live in a state of society, so.
Yeah, we aren't the end-all be-all, but we are the Reed Rothbard podcast, and we just, you know, two guys having a conversation.
That's right.
We hope you find it interesting at the very least.
Yeah, and like we said, if you have any comments or suggestions or clarifications, we'd love to hear them. I'm Robert at ReedRothbard.com.
And this guy over here is Daniel at ReedRothbard.com. We run ReedRothbard.com. We have books, lectures, podcasts, two podcasts now, Enemy of the State and the Reed Rothbard podcast. We've got bunch of links, Amazon links. We've got a bunch of affiliate stuff. Click on a couple of those. Support us if you want. We've got a Patreon page. We're on iTunes, Google Play Music, YouTube, all those places. So we appreciate you. We do. We really do. All three of you. Maybe
Absolutely.
Two of you. I don't know. Maybe four.
Who knows? But
who
yeah,
knows?
It's been our Red Dawn.
Wolverines. Wolverines.
Slash. Ripping apart Stefan Molyneux episode. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah. I think this was a good discussion. So I appreciate you, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you too, Daniel. It's been my pleasure.
All right, folks. Well, again, readrothbard.com. Check us out. Like, comment, share, rate, whatever you do. Give us some feedback, comments, what have you. And we will be back next week with the next episode. So with that, I bid you adieu. Good night, everyone.
Wolverines!
chipmunks.
C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.